comments on Serotalk Tech Chats are those of the individuals and do not represent Serotech Corporation, its staff, management, board of directors, or third-party resellers. Welcome to the latest Serotalk Tech Chat, powered by Accessible Event, a product of Serotech Corporation, giving the blind, deaf, and deafblind full access to classes, meetings, and webinars using Microsoft Word documents, Excel spreadsheets, PowerPoint slides, and web pages. 508 compliance is just one click away at www.accessibleevent.com. And now, here's your host, Michael Loft. Welcome to Serotalk Tech Chat 96. It's Beep Baseball in 2011. This is Michael Loft. We have three guests with us today. Eric Mazarigos, hope I'm saying that correctly.
That's very good.
Member of the West Coast Dogs, an all-star MVP, both defensively and offensively. Where are the Dogs out of? What's your base city?
We are primarily based from the Bay Area, and we have players from Texas predominantly. So predominantly our team's combined of California, Bay Area, and then players from Texas, and then our pitchers from Oklahoma. So we're a little spread out.
Kevin Barrett, who's a historian and curator of the Hall of Fame for Beat Baseball, also second vice president for public relations, and I understand one of the best pitchers you have, which is something we're going to talk about shortly, because when I played the very first season, they didn't even have pitchers. It just sat on the mound because, well, I haven't even thought about pitching balls to the blind folks yet, but good to have you with us, Kevin.
Yeah, thank you. Nice to be here. Thanks for having us.
And a voice you may have heard before, Stephen Guerra. He's a NBBA, that's National Beat Baseball Association secretary.
Beat Baseball guy, when I used to do the podcast, and one of the last podcasts I did actually was with Eric back in December of 2008. 07, something like that.
I guess we should start with first delineating, or maybe just give an overview, explain how this works. It is slightly different from what we think of as baseball or Major League Baseball in terms of the rules and how the game is played and so forth, but it has evolved as well. So let's start with, I don't know, do you want to take this, Steve, and just kind of give an overview of the game, how it's played, so people have that perspective?
Sure. Beat baseball really is an adaptive form of the game of baseball. It is played with a ball and bases that beep. The ball emits a rapid beep where the bases emit a buzz, and those bases are fixed down the third and first base lines. The object of the game, because the pitcher and catcher are on the same team as the batting team, unlike baseball where the pitcher's on the opposing team, the pitcher's object is to put the ball in the area or pitch the ball in the area where the batter is swinging. That pitcher stands about 20 feet from home plate to increase the accuracy of hitting the ball. So the batter hits the ball and then listens for which base is turned on, because their base is not chosen in advance and there's no set method, so you could either be running to first or third. So it becomes a foot race between the batter running to the base and also the defense fielding the ball. The batter reaches the base, he scores a run for the team, and if the defense, of course, picks up the ball and shows clean possession of it, it's awarded as an out. There are three outs in an inning, six innings in a game. The bases are 100 feet from home plate. There are four strikes and one take for every batter. Every player on the field, whether it be defense or at bat, are wearing a blindfold, so the playing field is made level. There are no advantages by those who are partially sighted versus those who are totally blind. Again, this sport has been around since the first World Series of Beat Baseball was played in fall of 1975, and we are in our 36th season and going to be playing our World Series in Indianapolis, Indiana, during the week of August 1st, 2011.
So there's 19 active teams right now. I'm curious how many of those are in the States.
One in Taiwan. Well, Taiwan, I think, has a group of multiple teams, and they always bring over an all-star team. But in the United States, there's at least 18 teams. A couple others have surfaced as well, so they're not registered. But we're looking at now 21 teams in the United States.
So are these kind of like by city? Are they larger markets?
The by city is really depends on where anyone really wants to start up a beat baseball team. I mean, there's two in the city of Indianapolis. I mean, our membership has steadily increased over the last 3 years from 269 members all the way up to 369 members. So, of course, more members means more teams and more people, and it just means the sport is growing once again like it used to be back in the 80s and 90s.
Also, it fell off for a little bit. Now it's kind of revitalizing.
No, not necessarily fell off. It was a status quo. It became a where the teams that survived, you know, like the teams like the West Coast Dogs and the Austin Blackhawks and other teams like that have maintained themselves over the last 20 years and such. There seems to be more of an interest. And I think as a result of maybe leagues such as Challenger Leagues throughout the United States, there are more kids growing up who are wanting to be more athletic and are either starting up or finding someone in their local area to allow them to have the opportunity to play beat baseball.
Much more difficult to get information to folks who are blind and visually impaired, especially younger folks, as they became more mainstreamed in the regular schools and so forth. But now I think we're starting to finally reach some with some concerted effort, and I think the internet, the web, that has got to be helping. Whereas many years ago, when people focused a lot into the blind schools, it was easier to find the blind athlete. I know with our limited resources, sometimes it was just really harder to get the information out to a lot of places where it could reach the right people.
That's a big part of it, Michael, is getting a lot of volunteers to sustain a team, and finding a pitcher is not necessarily an obstacle, but it helps attract people if you have a pitcher that's good, because it's, you know, it's fun to hit the ball.
Kevin is still pitching to some degree. Kevin is probably known as being probably the safest pitcher out of all of the pitchers that in our league, because he wears so much protective equipment.
Smartest pitcher, yeah.
That was one of my other questions, what you wear for protective wear. I mean, we did it. We just went out. I mean, we just went on our street clothes. There was no uniforms. There was no, you know, eyewear. Pitchers certainly would have to be.
Yeah, they look a lot like a sighted baseball catcher. That's what I usually do. I would don shin guards and the catcher's softball catcher's mask is what I use. And, of course, I have my regular baseball mitt. There have been others that have done that, too, where at least a mask, maybe soccer shin guards, knee pads. I don't recall if anybody has ever worn, like, maybe a small chest protector underneath their jersey. I thought of it, but never did, because I figured, one, you'd probably just get too darn hot, and it might restrict your movement.
Right. I didn't know two people ever collided trying to catch the same ball, or if there's generally been enough distance it hit. Yeah.
Sure. Yeah, there's situations where players will stumble upon each other, but, you know, these defenses with their practice and working together, they're so proficient at it that some of these guys have a feel for each other where they will literally come together and know how to move to make the play, almost like a couple of synchronized swimmers or something.
Doesn't happen as often as you would think as far as collisions and that type of thing, because you know your zones as long as you know your area and don't go out of your zone. But, I mean, it does happen on occasion, but it's pretty rare. And there's sighted spotters that can yell stop if it's going to be a real bad collision.
The pitcher for the West Coast Dogs is named Tim Hibner. And when he was pitching with a team that was out of Oklahoma several years ago, in a finals game, pitching with that team, and then they were playing Houston, it was 2003, he took a pitch off the nose, broke his nose, and he set it in place himself, and he continued to pitch through the rest of the finals. I mean, they lost, but, I mean, he refused to take himself out of the game and go to the hospital and get his nose set or whatever. But it's that type of craziness that, because Kevin is so smart in how he protects himself, that we wish that more pitchers would do that. But it's even sometimes a stretch for them to even wear a cup.
Yeah, they're only 20 feet away.
Protective cup, yeah, I do that as well. In fact, I started doing that first when I first joined. I was a player because of an emergency. We had a sighted pitcher in our early years, and he couldn't show up for a game at the last minute. I filled in, and ended up, he couldn't come back because of a job change. As a player, they didn't miss much. I wasn't that good anyway, so at least I found a way to contribute to the sport, which has been really gratifying.
So how does this work as far as the World Series, since it encompasses a whole week? Does every team get to go and do playoffs, everything done there? Or are there some eliminations that take place first?
If you pay your funds, if you pay the fee of $310 and register to go to the World Series, then you can go. There aren't any playoffs. If we got to a point of having too many teams, maybe we would then do it that way, but we haven't crossed that bridge yet. Right now, if you pay, then you come. Right now, we'll have probably about 18 or 19 teams at the World Series, so it's going to be a little bit difficult in the bracketing and such, but they're going to probably play one extra game than everybody else on Wednesday. Tuesday, everyone plays a round robin. Then we'll start the championship game. So in the championship round, the additional teams will play an extra game in order to get into the actual championship bracket.
And then it's double elimination from that point forward after you do the round robin.
Yeah, as the league grew, the World Series became an open invitation tournament starting in 1983. Prior to that, it was a qualifying event where there was like four major tournaments back in the early years out of Phoenix, Minneapolis, the Chicago area, and I believe Texas, Sioux Falls, and they would advance the teams that won those tournaments to the World Series. Which used to be held a little later in August back in the early years. And in fact, the first couple of years, it was actually, they believe, in September to accommodate a lot of our volunteers, our teachers, et cetera. We eventually had to move the World Series up to now, the end of July, early August, because a lot of schools go back early. And then starting in 83, when the World Series was held in Minnesota, it became an open tournament. Any team interested that joined the NBBA paid the entry fee and came and participated. It's been that way ever since. And the World Series is probably our big selling point. That's the thing that really excites people. When they get to that sometimes that really makes the athletes and volunteers just fall in love with it, and they just can't wait to get back the next year.
So I understand this year you're going to actually have ESPN coverage. Has that ever happened before? Or?
Back in 2006 at the World Series in Cleveland, we had ESPN E-Ticket do a story at Love at First Beep, which is a link on our NBBA homepage featuring Wayne and Kevin Sibson. This E60 is something completely different. They contacted the NBBA right out of the gate. This is going to be an exciting time because we're going to be able to feature different people on their route to the World Series, Eric being one of those people.
Give everyone an overview of all about the history of Beep Baseball, starting back one of the creators, John Ross, and how he came about, and information that you have about John Ross and other people that were founders of Beep Baseball back in the 70s and such, and maybe bring us up to date where you are and about the Jim Queen Award as well, too.
Some of the names that Steve just mentioned, John Ross, James Mastro, Ed Bradley, and others in the mid-1970s pretty much wrote the rules that we know as the rules of the NBBA or competitive beep baseball. The beep baseball or audio softball was invented by the telephone pioneers of America in the 1960s to provide a device for blind and visually impaired children to work and develop their motor skills. And that was invented by pioneer Charlie Fairbanks. Now, as time evolves and attitudes and views of challenging the visually impaired or other disabilities start to improve in regards to letting them be involved in more normal activities, it became obvious that a more challenging set of rules need to be developed to make the game more fun, more challenging for the advanced, ever-improving blind and visually impaired athlete. So John, Jim Mastro, who is actually a PhD in physical fitness now, along with another 10 guys from around the country, Denny Huberty, Ed Doc Bradley, the late Jim Quinn, they got together and wrote the rules and started the National Beep Baseball Association. And they had the first World Series, 75, 76. In 1975, the St. Paul Gorillas played the Minnesota Braille Sports Foundation team with the first run at what eventually evolved into our current World Series of Beep Baseball. Jim Quinn, who was one of the founding members, he was on the BSF team, and he was a gentleman who lost his sight to diabetes. And he was a very active individual. He was a carpenter by trade, put his heart and soul into the sport in its early years. Unfortunately, diabetes claimed his life in 1981, so his playing days were actually a short run, but his impact and contribution to the game still lives on to this day, where we have our highest honor, which is an award for dedication to the sport and service to the blind, which is called the Jim Quinn Award. And we award this to one deserving member each year at our World Series banquet. This award is issued to volunteers, players, and any member can nominate an individual for this award. And they're kept on file, and we have a committee that reviews them and selects an individual each year. The game of beep baseball has really opened up a lot of avenues for folks to help them overcome adversity. And now we have a game that gives the individual an opportunity to not just have something to do, but something they can really excel at and enhance their self-confidence, improve their physical well-being, develop camaraderie, and develop friendships with other individuals. One thing that we hear from people that get involved with this sport is, I wish I would have known about this sooner. This is great. For those who may lose their sight due to an accident or something, or with some of our efforts today to reach the young veterans, this game has really helped people get back a part of their life that for some they thought they would never be able to do something like this again, get out and be physically active and play ball, and it can be very therapeutic. I remember when we hosted the World Series in Cleveland back in 2001, one of our volunteers of health was one of my colleagues from the Lions, and he wrote an article that appeared in the Ohio Lion newsletter. And he had helped out with blind golf and other things, and the thing that he found most remarkable, and he made a very good point about this, is, and as part of our message, is developing independence. He says, it's amazing how the blind golfers get teed up, and their spotter helps them approach the ball and so forth. But here I see these beat baseball players. They do so much by themselves on their own, running with full abandon 100 feet toward a buzzing base with no assistance. It was just remarkable to him. He just couldn't get over how much it demonstrated how people can adapt to a disability and overcome that disability and accomplish things that the sighted take for granted. They wanted a game that was more challenging because the Pioneers, a gentleman named Mr. Rock, had developed a special set of rules for mainly for blind children back in the early 70s, late 60s, where the kids would hit the ball off a tee and then walk to a buzzer in a cone. On defense, they would call the name of one of the kids, and only that child or person could move to go and locate and pick the ball up. But it wasn't challenging enough, and it, you know, like they said, I don't want to be treated like a baby, as the saying would go.
That was my first exposure.
That was mine as well.
Something that really makes me break a sweat. And when other sports are developing for the blind at the same time with USABA and so on, it was just a matter of time where, and like the John Ross and them felt, they wanted a game for the blind, by the blind, so they could set up the rules and make the decisions about how the game was played, because it is their game. Volunteers are very helpful and very appreciated, and we can't do it without them. We can't do it without the technology. But ultimately, it is the game for those who are blind and visually impaired. And these fellas got together and set this thing up, and here we are 36, 37 years later. And like Steve mentioned earlier, we're starting to finally see some growth again. As we're getting the word out, and a new generation of folks are being introduced to this stuff, and hopefully like we did, they're going to fall in love with it. And it looks like they are. I just remember when I helped in Stockton 2 years ago when my team couldn't go. It was the one time I had a chance to really look around and just see a lot of new faces and meet people and realize that, you know, we're starting to finally get some young, energetic, visually impaired individuals involved with this, and that's important because of the fact that society as a whole is getting so sedentary, and that can be more of an issue for the blind. To get them out getting some exercise, it can't help but benefit their health in a variety of ways.
So let's talk about some of the gear that you wear. When I did it, we just went out in street clothes. Like you said, it was really dumbed down. So what protective wear do you have? Eric can talk about what he wears as a pitcher to protect himself, but what do the players wear?
From a player, I mean, it varies, but what I generally wear is hip pads, football hip pads, knee pads, and forearm and elbow pads. Not everybody wears the hip pads, but it saves on your hips, especially, you know, it's different from baseball in that you're diving every play. You know, it's not a thing where in baseball you might dive once in a game to make a play. You know, in beatball, you're diving on every play that you have a shot to make.
Yeah, that's right. Both on offense and defense. And diving into the base, and they're diving for a play on defense.
Yeah.
And then diving for the Gatorade.
Something that I was mentioning before, Michael, is that every player has to wear a blindfold. So that's a standard issue piece of equipment.
I was going to ask that. So even blind folks have to wear blindfolds, so there's no chance of someone either faking having a little bit of vision or a little bit of an advantage over someone else.
Exactly.
Correct.
Okay, are there any?
That's how that developed.
Yeah, okay, very good. Yeah, everything kind of comes out of necessity. Are there any females playing or involved in the organization at any level?
Oh, yeah.
There are two current females in our league. One is with the Wichita Sonics. Her name is Debbie Brummer. She is an older veteran player, and yet another veteran player who's been around net quite as long as Debbie Brummer is Kalari Gertley from the Chicago Comets. Of course, you have Jennifer Boylan out from the Stockton Stingrays, and there's still quite a few. There's Rosie Reed from Tyler Tigers, Tyler, Texas. There are others, don't come immediately to my mind, but there is a small minority amount of women in our sport, but the sport is open to all. We've been asked on several different occasions if there's any age limit We would ask that those who are teenagers and who want to participate, if they've participated in other team sports and they're used to the possibilities of knowing that the ball is going to be coming out at them at an undetermined amount of speed, whether on the ground or on a fly, if they are aware of and if the parents are aware of that, then they can play. We've had teenagers play as young as 16 years old, but the only documented teenager that we've had pitch in the league was a Jared Woodard, who's pitching this year with the RHI Extreme. And he started pitching at about 12 or 13 years old, but is a phenomenal pitcher, as Eric can probably attest.
I think he was even 11 when he started. He is an amazing pitcher.
So let's talk about the financial investment involved in terms of uniforms and travel and just being a part of the World Series in Indianapolis or whatever city it may be in future years. What is the cost that you have as an individual to participate in this?
That really varies in terms of, you're looking at just giving some ballpark expenses. A ball will run $31. A single charger for that ball is $7. A set of bases with the electronics is $300. And uniforms, of course, can range anywhere between, depending on how cheap you want to go, from $25 to $50. Of course, then you have the traveling to and from the regional tournament, if your team is going to go to any of those, and the room and board for that, plus the World Series. And, of course, the team paying the World Series registration fee, which is $310. Plus their individual membership dues to the MBBA, which is $10 a person. It could probably, if you really wanted to outfit yourself and really contribute into some degree, it could cost you almost in upwards of $500 at the very least, plus, you know, whatever on top of that, maybe travel costs. If your local team has dues, and some do, but that also can be offset by how active you are individually and as a member of the team in fundraising. Some teams are successful in doing that, and some of the teams are not. And some of the teams will say, well, it's going to cost you this amount of money to play this year. Buck up. It's an expensive sport. You know, in our document that we have available on our website, Beat Baseball in a Nutshell, it really does lay out the overall ideas too, that this is what is essentially going to cost a team to get started, because of course it'd be baseball, even though we are thankful for the telecom pioneers and Bob Kurtz and his staff who make the balls entirely on a voluntary basis, and they cost at $31 per ball. They don't make them for profit. They sell them at the cost it costs them to make the ball. And sometimes those balls, depending on how well they're put together, can either last one hit or a whole game. Preferably, if they last a whole game, then you might be able to get away with, in terms of practices, in game, any scrimmages that you might have. You might be able to get away with maybe purchasing 10, maybe 20 balls, but it's certainly not unheard of for teams to have a host of dead balls to practice with for batting practice and or for not the brand new balls or reused balls for that matter that may not have the as loud of a beep for defensive practice. You try to make do with what you have, and those balls can be repaired, but again, that's $21. So you try to take everything into consideration, and of course fundraising for each year really is dependent on a team coming. And one of the teams I want to give credit to who has come to our World Series at least the last 3 years, at the very least, for on that string of World Series attendance, is Taiwan, the Taiwan Home Run. They start their fundraising in January and really do all that they possibly can to fly to the World Series that year, and because their diet is so unique. There are dietary needs that need to be filled, which are sometimes outside of the realm of what maybe a hamburger and hot dog can do. I believe most of the people from the Taiwan team are vegetarian. But a lot of things are done with local Taiwan organizations throughout the United States where the World Series is held, so that team can be accommodated. But then again, each year as World Series go on, there are more and more events, so the cost for food or meals is less for the players and teams really to take care of on their own, such as in 2011, five out of the six nights that a team will be at the World Series, there will be dinners provided for all the teams at no cost. So that's a tremendous asset and tremendous plus And certainly one of the things I'm looking forward to, because, again, it can get expensive. You know, hotels and eating in a restaurant, Michael, as you probably know, it's not cheap.
So let's talk about, because we mentioned this before we got started, I wanted to mention about injury, and you can make your comment as well there, but I wanted to then follow up and talk about injury. Certainly the pitcher is probably greatest risk, but you talked about how players can work together and prevent collisions. I realize they're both very close and kind of work out a strategy to between the two of them to get the ball before the person gets to base. So we can talk about that.
Well, yeah, essentially what you're doing is you're tracking the ball and your teammate's tracking the ball at the same time. If there's a close play, you've worked out some type of system, either letting them know, A, I'm going for it, which tells them slow down, or B, you tell them, your ball, and you yell out their name so they know to start to go faster for the ball. But a lot of that is, and it's one of the big things on defense, is you're communicating. When the ball goes by me, I say, by me, and that gives the guy behind me the green light to be more aggressive to go for the ball. Or if the ball goes off me, I might say, off me, Mike. So Mike knows it went off me and it's in his area, and he knows he has the green light. So that prevents a lot of the collisions from happening, and knowing your position and knowing, you're not going to run. If you're on the left field side, you're not going to just take off like a bat out of hell to the right field side, just playing reckless. So,
right, you have to count your players in each area.
That you work on it in practice.
So let's talk about the average
Go ahead.
I was just asking about the average game length and kind of how that works.
It varies about 2 hours, maybe 2.5 hours. It really depends on the pitchers. It depends on if they have a high amount of strikeouts in a game, or if they're making contact with the ball. And if you give an example of a team such as West Coast Dogs, if you're playing against them, and if Tim Hibner, their pitcher, is on, and they're putting the ball on the bat, it's you run into a 12-run rule situation where now the offensive team, who's 12 runs up, now goes out into the field and plays defense for the rest of the game, and the other team either has to catch up and go ahead, or they play out the rest of their innings at bat until the game is over. So it could be an hour and a half, or it could be 3 hours long. I mean, there are games that sometimes have gone 4 or 5 hours long, but it really depends on the scenario of what's going on exactly. Of course, you have the more competitive teams, or the teams that are more of a championship caliber, such as an Austin Blackhawks and West Coast Dogs, you might see that game become more of a defensive battle. Or you might even see like a Taiwan and West Coast Dogs go where it goes, last year in the 2010 World Series, West Coast Dogs had a 9-4 lead, and Taiwan came back in the bottom of the fourth inning and put up 7 spot, and it went to 11-9, and then went back and forth. And if not for the, if not being the most dramatic World Series championship game that I've ever seen, and Alexis Gillette coming up at the bottom in the bottom of the sixth in baseball fashion and scoring a run, is Alexis Gillette being probably the fastest man in the NBBA. West Coast Dogs won 12-11. So I mean, it can be a nail biter, or it can be a blowout. It really depends on the pitchers, and you hope that the pitchers are coming ready, and you hope everyone's on. But you have other teams that sometimes they don't get started till like the fourth inning. So if you have a lower ranked team who is not necessarily who's a relatively new team versus a team such as say Houston, a team like Houston might not necessarily get started till like the third or fourth inning. But once the pitcher comes into his own, they'll put up a good 10 runs per inning, if not more, and that's pretty typical. You want to try to score between 10 to 15 runs in a game if you're lucky to win a game. You hope you don't have to score that many, but, and again, Kevin and Eric, correct me if I'm wrong. I mean, that's generally about what you want to win.
Yeah, you want to get about 15, and one of the things they've done, Michael, which was a really good thing in beatball, the bases used to be 90 feet from home plate, and we had really high-scoring games, and we had really, you'd have 3.5, 4-hour games on a regular basis. And the defensive part of the game is the harder part. So what they did, they said, oh, well, let's push the base back 10 feet, and that has dramatically shortened the games. It's made the quality of the defense better because, you know, A, you have more teams that have more than just one or two good defensive players. You have teams now that have, you know, six good defenders, and you got that extra 10 feet. So before, when you made a good play, if someone was fast, it didn't matter that you made a good play on defense because the base was 90 feet. They hit a pop-up. By the time the ball landed, you had one shot at it, and boom, they scored. So, I mean, we had a championship game in 93, and I remember that was like my fourth year of playing, and it was 60-44 was the final.
Wow.
And now you'll find more like, you know, 10-9 or 15-12. That's more of an average championship game. You know, a couple of years ago we had a high-scoring one, and it was 28-22.
Yeah.
Yeah, now it was for today's standards, that was a really high-scoring game. Part of that was you had two good offensive teams, but you had a really quick field, and the field can also determine whether it's going to be a very defensive game or an offensive game. If the grass is cut real short, then generally the games are a little more high-scoring.
So what constitutes as a catch?
Really,
I mean, what would be not an authentic catch? I'm just curious how specific are the rules of saying you actually have the ball?
We call it a put-out. In beatball, it's a put-out. I mean, if you made literally a catch like you do in baseball, the inning is automatically over. And you don't try to catch the ball like you do in baseball. You try to block it with your body, and you have to have it off the ground and under control and away from your body for it to be to be a put out.
Right, that was my question. You can't trap it. You can't just
fall
on it
or
put your foot or be on the ground.
Yeah.
Okay, gotcha.
Right, yeah, you have to have clean possession. You have to have it, like Derek just mentioned, away from your body. There are many people who like to trap the ball, and some umpires, and yeah, the umpires are really a piece of gold for the NBBA because there are so few of them. But there are some times that, of course, on the typical framework of what an umpire is looked at, there are some times that they make some calls that are just absolutely questionable. You know, and someone, you could be on your bench at bat, and you see the other team, they trap the ball, and it looks like a clear trap. And it's like, he trapped the ball, and of course, you can't necessarily argue with the umpire, but I mean, sometimes it works out that way, and there's nothing really you can do about it. But you know, you try to hope that there's a level playing field for all, where you know the rule is defined as where there has to be clean possession away from the body, and if there's not, then I mean, there's very little gray area there.
I want to ask about pitching with Kevin.
One thing that the umpires are
Go ahead, Eric.
I would say the umpires in BPAR are at a little bit of a disadvantage compared to regular baseball because, you know, baseball, the first base umpire, he's right there where the play is at, where the ball, the runner, everything's all in one spot. In BPAR, it's different because you have a first base and a third base, and you don't know which one's going to get turned on. So the umpire in BPAR has a lot to juggle. He has a field umpire that's out in the field helping him out, watching when the guy's picking up the ball, but so, like Steve was saying, there are some plays that are a little bit, you know, you're not sure if it's the right call or not. But it's a little harder to be the umpire in beatball because it's, you know, you got action going on in different places of the field.
So I want to talk to Kevin about the pitching aspect of it and how much you vary it. Do you vary it based on the players and you kind of learn what their skills or their weaknesses are? Or because you're only 20 feet away, so it's a little different from, you know, the way it's done in Major League so forth. So I'm curious, how much that deviates? Do you do fast, slow, high, low? How many different pitching styles do you have to accommodate different hitters?
Well, basically what you try to do is you try to keep it as simple as possible. The best thing to do is it's best for the hitter to adjust to the pitcher's velocity. And then the pitcher's job is to maximize contact with the help of the catcher. They want to put the ball on the fat part of the bat. And this is done through repetition and practice because they don't listen to the ball. They listen to the pitcher's voice. They use the voice cue, set, ready, pitch. And the hitter is normally supposed to swing when they hear the word pitch. So based upon that timing, by keeping everything consistent, you should maximize contact. And over the years, a lot of these teams have gotten very, very good at this. Like Eric had just mentioned, near the end of the 1990s, they did that. That's part of why they moved the base back. The offense had advanced so much because of this practice. The athletic skill of these athletes and these pitchers had really got to a point where they were really dominating the game, especially on a fast track. Like that 60-some, the 40-some title game was very hot, dry conditions with two of the most powerful hitting teams in the league's history playing each other. So with two of the best pitchers in history, I think might have been Frank Mathena from Fort Worth and Kevin Sipson from Austin, Texas, I believe. That might have been the game. I really don't know for sure.
Right.
I have in front of me. But nonetheless, practice. And always with the Cleveland team, and of course the famous Lone Star pitcher, Frank Mathena, he wrote our pitcher's manual. And his gospel was no die hitters. And again, the hitter should adjust to the pitcher, and he tries to adjust his hitter's swings. And you try not to change the hitters too much if they have a nice natural swing. And then your job is to work on getting that ball there. And their responsibility is to keep the bat in the same place and keep the time in the same. And then as they advance, some of the hitters get really good at spraying the ball, especially after they've worked together with the same pitching staff or pitcher for a long time. We had a guy on the Cleveland team. He was an older gentleman, but he had played sighted ball. He could literally, at our practices, call where he was going to hit the ball. And I could just drop it, throw it right down the middle, and he'd yell out to the right fielder, you know, hey, Russell, be ready, or whatever. And he would do it time and again. Just all based on just a very slight adjustment in the timing to, like, inside out the ball or to pull the ball. And he'd tell me, get ready to duck, I'm going to hit it right over the mound. And he would about 9 out of 10 times. He was just remarkable. And some players get better at it. It's a little hit and miss because, let's face it, in sighted ball where they can see it, it's considered one of the most challenging things involved organized sport to do. And so now we're doing it all based upon sound, feel, and touch. We have that added challenge. So that's another variable. I kind of liken it to the pitcher, the catcher, and the hitter in beat baseball are a lot like the snapper, the place kicker, and the holder in football. Those three have to be on the same page. It takes a lot of work and a lot of practice. Even those football players, they have the advantage. They can see what they're doing. And it's a challenge for coaches. You know, we've had long-time experienced coaches in sighted ball that will work with us. And it's a lot different to try and teach these techniques by touch or by feel rather than not being able to say, well, the next time you watch the game and watch how such and such swings the bat, you know, take a look at a guy like Jim Rice or something like that, or take a look at what Barry Bonds could do in his prime or something. Something like that, you know. Some years ago, we had the opportunity with the Cleveland Scrappers to work with a former Indians player named Joe Charbonneau, who was the American League's 1980 Rookie of the Year. Well, he had opened a hitting school. So in the early 90s, somebody got us in touch with him, and he donated time to work with our hitters. And he was just so enthralled with it that he saw it as a personal challenge, and he worked with us for a couple of seasons and developed techniques of how to help the blindfolded hitter by touch and so forth. And eventually he wanted to try it, and this is always kind of a funny story, is the fact that the one time that I did strike out Joe Charbonneau, a big league player, because he couldn't hit the ball beatball style. So... So what do you mean you struck out Joe Charbonneau? You know, so, well, you know, that's one of those things. But yeah. It was a great experience for him and for us, and it's one of those things that it's a unique athletic pursuit that when people just happen to casually look at it, they don't think it's that big of a deal. But a lot of time and work goes into it. We go out and we'll hit buckets of dead balls for hours. We would do that, especially in our earlier years when we were first developing the team. I was learning as I went. We hadn't joined the NBBA right away. We did a lot of this off the seat of our pants. I had not met Frank Mathena yet. I had never read his manual. You know, Marty Skutnik and myself and a couple other early scrappers, such as Wilbur Turner and the late Leonard Williams, we just worked and worked and worked and worked our butts to get to the World Series so we could learn from the better teams and witness what was going on. And any new team will tell you that the best way to learn to play the game is to go and play with the best competition and take your lumps and grow from it. And, of course, like we talked about earlier, the funding is a real big issue.
It's an excellent message because, you have teams that have come out of, say, Stockton, California, Wichita, Kansas, and you have any newer team that's coming to the league, and keep on trying to impress upon them for any new teams is to come to the World Series, learn from everyone else, not only on the field and playing ball, and maybe you're taking a licking. But it's the afterwards in the interaction with the other players and the players from the West Coast Dogs or the players from other teams that you can interact with, and maybe you might fundamentally learn something that you didn't know before. And it's the whole learning experience for a new team that allows you to go and see a team start to excel and start to really turn that corner from being a new rookie team to being a team that is now starting to climb that ladder. One of those teams that I want to give kudos to is the Boston Renegades. They are there in and out for the last at least 10 years at World Series competitions, and they are really coming ready to play, and it doesn't matter who they take on, whether it be the West Coast Dogs or whether it be the Bayou City Heat from Houston or whomever. They're giving it their all, and they're using all their fundamental techniques that they practice twice a week with to put runs up on the board and also to win the games. And they really have started to turn that corner for the best that you'll see probably in the next 5 to 10 years, hopefully, that Boston Renegades will be at the top of the heap over everybody else. And hesitate to say, I don't know how much longer the West Coast Dogs can be champions, but that's just my opinion, that I think you'll see other teams starting to really excel in the future.
Yeah, and Steve, you say that about teams, sticking with it, and that's, the coach of our team, Don Robinson, did back in the early 90s and late 80s. He watched, what it took for you to be good on defense. So he went out and he would take notes, on the better players, and then he brought that back, to our team. Okay, well, this is what you need. This is what the fundamentals are for defense, and this is what you need to do. And he did a lot of one-on-one work with me back in the early 90s, just going out and hitting the ball out to me and just working that stuff and being a coach, getting a solid foundation of the fundamentals of to what it takes to be a good defender. Because a lot of times he would see people just go and lay down and not necessarily listen to the ball. They'd get down really, really early, or, so he took notes of some of the bad habits and the good habits, and he pushed us forward from there, and that's very true. You got to take your lumps along the way and learn from the better teams.
Eric, I want you to tell the story to everyone who's listening that you have told me several times before about the time that you and Don went out in the middle of the infield of a track where there was a track team taking practice with, you remember?
Oh, yes. So Don and I, oftentimes would get together for just one-on-one defensive practices, and we had this field by where I work, so it was convenient for me, and it was right next to Bart. So I'm getting ready, I'm putting my hip pads, putting all my gear on, and there's some high school students, probably about maybe 60 or 70 yards from us, and Don, he's legally blind, but he's got a lot more vision than I do, and one of them is saying something to him and giving him a bad time or whatever, and he's kind of like, what's their problem type of situation, and I'm just I'm ignoring, I'm getting ready to practice, and it turned out they were basically telling us to watch out, basically, because they were doing archery practice. But neither one of us knew that was the situation, and he's ready to rumble with these kids because I guess they were giving him some lip or what, he wasn't quite sure what they were trying to tell him. So,
professional javelin catchers?
Yeah, exactly.
But you were all right,
Right, so as we come near an end, there's a couple things I want to ask. Yeah. One of them being, this year is going to be, you had some press coverage before, but this year is really going to take the national coverage to an all-new level. Let's talk about what's going to happen at the World Series this year in Indianapolis as far as media.
Well, first, I want to go on the record and say that if not for the efforts by the Indianapolis Parks and Recreation Group for bidding on the 2011 World Series, we wouldn't be able to have a World Series this year. So, thank you to them, as well as the people who run and maintain Geist Park, which is in Indianapolis. The Beat Baseball World Series is going to be held. The game's going to start on Tuesday, August 2nd at Geist Park, and will continue through Saturday, August 6th. And, of course, more information can be found on the Beat Baseball World Series, about the Beat Baseball World Series on the NBBA homepage. But the media coverage is really going to be, as what Michael's saying there, at a new level, because ESPN E60 has contacted the NBBA and has asked us to follow several of our athletes, one of those being Eric Mazariegos, to their path from now, the beginning of the season, through the season, to the Beat Baseball World Series. And this really has never been done before. There has been a piece done by ESPN E-Ticket previously, called Love It First Beep, which is, again, a link on the NBBA homepage that you can go and view. It's about 15 minutes long. It features Wayne Simpson and his brother Kevin, and who's my brother-in-law, by the way. And ESPN E60 is the, I guess, the sports version of 60 Minutes. And they're going to be following several of our athletes through the season and into the World Series. And it will be featured and aired the first week of October. One of the wonderful things that we would like to promote also is that the NBBA, during the finals game, provided that ESPN is going to film it, if there is a play of the game, there is speculation that because the affiliation that ESPN E60 has with Baseball Tonight, if there's a spectacular play of the game, we hope to see it on that night of August 6th on ESPN's Baseball Tonight as play of the game. So that is really going to allow the NBBA to ascend to a level that it's never been before and introduce the game of Beat Baseball to a whole new group of audience. And that's really raising a lot of great excitement, not only within the organization, but also amongst the people who are going to be interviewed and contacted by the people from ESPN E60. It's spectacular, and we're hoping that it's only going to benefit the NBBA now as well as into the future.
Okay, so let's talk about, let's say some folks are listening to this in a community and they want to start their own team. There's enough there. I think there's enough interest. What's kind of the procedure to get that started? And as I asked that, I get a text question.
They can certainly go into the... They can certainly go on our MBBA website and go to the About MBBA page, and information there from that it ranges from how to start a team, and that by reading the document called Beat Baseball in a Nutshell. And there's a whole series of contacts, including myself as secretary, Kevin as the second vice president who oversees public relations, etc., and any of our officers who can certainly lend a hand, if not only by phone or if by email or whatever, in whatever fashion, to really give individuals who are interested in starting a team. I would suggest that they read that document called Beat Baseball in a Nutshell, and by all means, contact anyone from the NBBA for any type of assistance. We're all here to help. And the president, Dan Green, who has been president since 2010, okay, and any of the board of directors and officers can go ahead and help out in any way.
Awesome. I have a question here. Someone asks, what are your thoughts on the so-called all-star teams? What are some of the advantages and disadvantages of all-star teams versus home teams? Eric, you want to start on that one?
Sure. As far as all-star teams, like Taiwan brings an all-star team to the World Series, our team in California and Texas has been described as a all-star team. Essentially what's happened, Michael, over the years is our team was pretty much a local team, homegrown team in the, you know, late 80s, early 90s, even up to mid and late 90s. Is, you know, you lose players, you know, people get married, they have kids, and life happens, and we, you know, that for us, you know, we still want to compete at a high level, so we've, you know, found players that are interested in playing with us, and it allows us to continue to go to the World Series and, you know, keep our team going forward. So, you know, there are definitely some disadvantages to all-star teams. Obviously, the teams that, that, you know, finish lower down the rung, they probably think, oh, well, they have an all-star team. Of course, you know, they should win. But, you know, the reality is it's been going on for many years. It's not anything new to our sport. Oklahoma did it for many years, and it's basically a way for teams to stay together and keep putting out a product on the field that that they're comfortable with as far as a high level of play.
And on the opposite side, Michael, the homegrown teams such as the Cleveland Scrappers and the Chicago Comets, etc., you know, the ultimate goal here is to field a team to go to the World Series. If you're financially able to do it, then you go to the World Series. If by some chance, because of attrition and people who are not able to play anymore, either because of work commitments or family commitments and such, you ultimately hope that that doesn't necessarily happen, but there are teams who sometimes have to go out and find an additional player. You know, there are teams that, and that's only for survival, and that's survival of the fittest. There are teams, of course, who are always looking for additional players and such, but we have several homegrown teams who are still together and still growing. You know, the Chicago Comets consistently brings about 40 people to the World Series every year, and that team is a homegrown team, and almost sometimes to the point that they field two teams, sometimes in their local regional tournament or even in other regional tournaments where maybe the A team goes to a more competitive tournament and maybe the B team goes to another tournament that, you know, ultimately everyone wants to win wherever they go. But it's maybe there isn't as you know, a Class A talent on that B team, say, for instance. But you try to make a homegrown team as much as you can, and you try to avoid the all-star team, if you will, and making up the all-star team. But sometimes you have to pull out all the stops in order just to field the team at the World Series. The ultimate dance is the World Series, and you do whatever you can
My
to get there.
My feeling is ultimately the ideal world. I would believe that it would be nice to not have to have any kind of a, quote, all-star team, because the sport would grow much more. Now, sometimes it happens out of necessity, because the city might be short people and so on, but the only thing I really take issue with is all-star teams that are being developed and built by design to be a power team. I think they do hurt the sport. There is no recourse to stop it, because it has gone on since the days of Albuquerque. When we first started going to the World Series in the late 80s, we didn't know anybody. But we found out, like, years later, that those great power Albuquerque teams were a mixture of people from all over the country. We always thought that kind of stunk. But once again, in the ideal world, it would be nice if there were no all-star teams. There were each community, metropolitan area, could develop their own team and players. I know that's not always possible. But that, to me, would be the ultimate goal, because in the long run, the sport would be beneficial, would benefit a lot more. More visually impaired would be reached. Once again, the resources available to get out and reach all these people is still being developed. You know, I wish we had a lot more funding and tools by which to do so and to get people to a team. That's not always possible. Transportation alone is becoming a big issue in many metropolitan areas as public transit gets cut. So right there, that could hurt. So there's a lot of variables, but in short, I really wish we didn't have to have all-star teams. It bothers me that Taiwan does what they do. They're missing the concept, but then again, there's a cost issue there, and they answer to their government. So there's not much we can do about that because we're trying to embrace them. So we, you know, we sort of put up with it.
Well, I guess my question then would be how many
so forth, but
how many of the last 10 World Series or so have been won by all-star teams? Is it a disproportionate amount enough to raise concern there, or?
I think the last homegrown team to win it was the 03 Chicago Comets.
Oh, wow. So, okay. All right. So now I see the significance.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's just, all-star teams do dominate. They can't help but do so. They have some of the best players. And occasional, some local teams, they stop coming because of it. They got demoralized. The saddest thing to me is, and this has happened very rarely, but when you see someone from a city playing on a power team and their team from their city is there, that breaks your heart. I think that's one of the saddest, most unfortunate episodes when you see something like that. That's always bothered me individually. I'm a big loyalty guy. Not that we ever won anything, but we had a pretty competitive team for a long time here in Cleveland, and there were times when we would get approached about jumping team, taking our best people and leaving our rest of our guys at home. And, you know, a lot of these teams are nonprofits. They fundraise together. For example, my team, we received some United Way money
I get help from the Lions, but that money is to help people from the greater Cleveland metropolitan area, not to go off playing for somebody else and using that money in an improper way, so that we have to answer to certain things. But ultimately, you want to do the right thing and build the sport in your community to benefit as many visually impaired people as possible and represent your community and just be a good sport about it. We all want to win, but let's do it the right way.
So I trust or assume that for the most part it's a friendly rivalry, right? Go ahead, Eric.
Yes, mostly. Yeah, there's some rivalries, but you know, that's sports. But there's no bad blood or anything like that. Just healthy competitive rivalries. You know, just like the Yankees and the Red Sox, they've played each other for so many years. You know, and they're both really good teams, and so you'll get some of that type of rivalry.
But no more than
normal. Sure. But you'll see one thing in our sport, that at the end of the day, everybody's a buddy. There's a lot of lifelong friendships that developed out of this. And it's a chance.
Sure.
Like one of us, my old interview that I was looking at, one of our tapes, it's like a big family reunion. This is the one chance to get together every year at the World Series and see the friends you've made in this sport over the years. Whole families have grown up in this sport. The Woodard family, the Perry family, and the Smolkas, among others. Volunteers, particularly out of the Pioneer organization, going back decades, have been faithfully coming back to help us ever since they were just introduced to, hey, you want to help with a project? They never stopped coming back. They always come every year. They plan their vacation time to help us. People who don't even have a member in their family who's sight impaired. So there's a lot of dedication, a lot of love, a lot of camaraderie, and it is. It's a cause. It's to advance the blind. It's to show that the blind belong in the mainstream of society. It's part of our educational message. We're trying to get out there and prove. Not that we should have to, but reality says you do. You gotta give them that lesson plan to show that these citizens can do stuff just like you do. They may just use a different tool by which to get it done with the technology and so forth, but they can play ball, they can hold on a job, they can go and get a higher education degree. Their parents, their grandparents, their husbands, their wives, just like anybody else. And this sport can teach people about that potential.
Well, awesome. That's going to put the wraps on this hour for Tech Chat 96. I want to thank Eric Mazarigos and Kevin Barrett and Stephen Guerra for sharing your expertise and passion for the game. I hope folks who are interested will certainly go. Yeah, nbba.org. Thank all of you very much. This concludes another Serotalk Tech Chat, powered by Accessible Event, a product of Serotech Corporation, giving the blind, deaf, and deafblind full access to classes, meetings, and webinars using Microsoft Word documents, Excel spreadsheets, PowerPoint slides, and web pages. 508 compliance is just one click away at www.accessibleevent.com. Until we meet again, stay connected and stay directed.